This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Emma Barnett and welcome to Woman's Hour from BBC Radio 4.
Good morning and welcome to the programme. I hope the weekend was a decent one. If you do have children, perhaps you're now happy to be back at work for a break. I say in inverted commas. But if you happen to live with a toddler, you're in luck, apparently, as they should all, for all of us, be our new self-help gurus, parents or not. So that's according to one of our guests today, who's compiled the evidence and can speak as both a paediatrician and parent. We're also going to be getting the latest on the suspected Westminster honey trap plot, because the first woman to speak publicly about being targeted has come out over the weekend. The Conservative MP, Dame Andrea Jenkins, said she too was messaged, becoming the latest MP to share in this experience, and has accused her Conservative MP colleague William Ragg of unforgivable behaviour after he handed over some MPs and Westminster staffers' phone numbers to a man he met on a gay dating app. Mr. Ragg has apologised for his actions, which he said were driven by fear on what sensitive and compromising material this individual had on him. I wanted to get your take on this and ask if you've ever been duped by someone outside of your contacts on your phone who'd messaged you. It can be more sophisticated than we assume. It may not be trying to send over images or get you to send sensitive images. It may be a text and then a number you're set to follow and you can't quite believe you did follow that. And then what happened? We'll be hearing from the former minister and former Conservative Deputy Chief Whip, Anne Milton, about this vulnerability in the corridors of power and what should be done. We'll be hearing from Anne shortly. But have you been targeted or duped? If you feel you can share, get in touch. The number is 84844. Text will be charged at your standard message rate. On social media at BBC Woman's Hour, or you can email me through the Woman's Hour website or send a WhatsApp message or voice note 03700 100 444. I'm aware, as I'm sharing those contact details, how much we live our lives on these devices, the so-called Black Mirror, as Charlie Brooker put it. But you may not have had a positive experience when it comes to receiving messages from those outside of your contacts. What happened? What happened next? What should happen in this particular scenario? We'll get into that very shortly. But also, belly button piercing. It's back. I'm as baffled by it as when it was first in fashion in the 90s and I was a kid. In fact, I'm personally baffled by all piercings. I don't have my ears pierced. I never quite understand the allure. I'm sure I'll be helped out by some of our guests today. Perhaps you can too. What is it? Why'd you do it? I'm going back whole, as they put it, and that's not a bad joke, as I came with no piercings. Although maybe, who knows what the future may hold, but I'm pretty safe to say I'm not planning on getting my navel pierced anytime soon, despite the recent spate of pop stars doing that and apparently more of us going back to it or doing it for the first time. I just remember people doing it, getting in a lot of trouble. That wasn't what put me off. And it getting infected and people smelling it. I'm so sorry to bring that up, but these are the memories. Why? You can get in touch on the same numbers. I'd love to hear from you. But going back to the corridors of power and abuse of power of those in power, potentially, the suspected honey trap plot targeting Westminster, which all began with the Conservative MP William Ragg, vice chairman, no less, of the Conservative Party's powerful 1922 scrutinising committee, admitting that he gave out personal phone numbers of colleagues to a person he'd met on a dating app. Several MPs, members of staff in Westminster and a political journalist have since said that they received said flirtatious messages and, in some cases, explicit photographs in what's been called a suspected spear phishing attack, which is a targeted cyber attack that tries to get its victims to reveal confidential information. The Met Police has confirmed it is carrying out an investigation following reports that a number of unsolicited messages were sent to MPs over recent months. And as I mentioned, the Conservative MP, Dame Andrea Jenkins, is the first woman to come out and say she too received messages. Yesterday she posted on social media, "I too received the WhatsApp and reported it." She goes on, "Unlike some MPs, I am not happy with William Ragg as a mother with a young child who only recently had threats. It's unforgivable of him to compromise the security of fellow MPs. Action is needed." Well, what action should that be? Anne Milton, former Conservative Deputy Chief Whip and a former Minister and MP, I'm sure we'll have some thoughts from her time in the Whip's office. But first, Noah Hoffman's here, the Sun's political correspondent, to bring us up to speed. Noah, I'm talking about honey traps. What exactly is going on in Westminster?
So what we've seen happening, or at least coming to light over the past week, is a series of what we call spear phishing expeditions, where MPs have been targeted by an individual who goes by the name of either Charlie or Abby. Charlie or Abby will then sort of send kind of sexualized messages in the hope, we believe, of receiving compromising material in return. And then once that material has been attained, they can then use it to sort of leverage either further information or, in the case of Will Ragg, the personal contact details of other MPs.
This situation then, do we know how widespread it is? Do we know how many may have been contacted? Because I'm maybe only able, as you are, to mention those who have said it already.
Yeah, so we believe that it's more than those who have come forward. It could be as many as dozens of MPs. We know of one political journalist as well. But a lot of this depends on, again, people deciding to reveal themselves as a target. So it could be more widespread than initially anticipated. Numbers are actually not super difficult to get around Westminster. So if this individual, if this individual was able to attain the number of quite a few MPs, once you have that sort of starting basket, it's not super difficult to then find the others.
Just for those who are thinking, I mean, I talked about spear phishing. There's a range of messages, but they seem to all be quite similar, don't they? Trying to show an explicit photograph and then perhaps get information back. Is that a fair way of summarising it?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so for those listening thinking, we entrust these in, you know, the corridors of power, whether it's MPs or staff, as to you know, be attuned to risk and to think about security, not least of the country. For those thinking, how has this happened? What does this say? What would you say in response to that?
So the public would be correct. MPs should be alert to these types of risks that unfortunately come with the job, and especially given the volatility of international affairs right now, although interestingly, it's not believed that this individual is sort of an agent of China. But nonetheless, the fact that there's been so much discussion and discourse about how vulnerable people in positions of power are when it comes to technology and social media, they should be alert. But interestingly, the individuals who are part of this attack have used what has historically and very famously been a weak spot, not for everyone, but for a lot of people, which is sex. And we saw that MP, like at least one MP, Will Ragg, did fall for that. So they were very, they were targeting people very specifically and using the sort of one area they believed would be a weak spot.
The question here, and I'll come to Anne Milton in just a moment on it, but the question of what should happen to William Ragg. Separate to this, he'd already announced he was stepping down whenever the next general election is. But what are people saying about that?
So there are a very wide range of opinions. There's a camp who do feel a lot of empathy for him, and split within them are those who just cannot deal with the Tories losing yet another by-election ahead of sort of the, or around the same time as the May local elections and then ahead of a general election. So some people will want to stop that from happening. Others will take into consideration that Mr. Ragg has spoken very openly about the fact that he has a plethora of mental health issues and has suffered seriously from depression. He's taken time out from being an MP because of his depression. This is all things that he's spoken about openly. And then there are people who thought, you know, you're a human being, you make mistakes as well. On the other hand, you have MPs such as Andrew Jenkins, such as Nadine Dorries. Let's also bear in mind that both of them are allies of Boris Johnson, who Will Ragg was no friend of, but nonetheless, they will come with a valid opinion. Some might agree with that. He was very silly. He put other MPs' safety, he compromised the safety of other MPs, and therefore he should be disciplined.
And also is on the 1922 committee, which is, for those who don't follow Westminster that closely, is an important committee when it comes to scrutiny within the Conservative Party at the very top.
And he also, interestingly, has a very long documented history of making sort of big common speeches about ethics, about how Parliament needs to be sort of cleaned up from the wrong-ins and the scandal. So I think that also piles pressure onto the team who feel he should be disciplined because they think there's an element of hypocrisy as well.
Let me, I should say at this point, we approached William Ragg for comment this morning, but haven't received a response. And the a House of Commons spokesperson for the BBC, to the BBC rather, said it took security extremely seriously and had provided MPs and staff with tailored advice to make them aware of risks online. Let me come to you, Anne Milton. And for first, perhaps your reaction to the first woman to come out about this, Dame Andrea Jenkins. She talked about being a mother with a young child. What's your take on that?
Well, I think if I was one of the MPs whose phone number was passed on, I'd be very angry. I think, you know, there's no occasion when one should give out the phone numbers of even your friends without checking with them first. But clearly, Will Ragg was under pressure. He felt that he was going to be threatened with exposure, and that's why he did it. I think my advice to Will Ragg would be not to wait for anybody to take any action. I would advise him to stand aside from everything that he is on and, you know, pass his remaining time in the House of Commons on the back benches out of the public eye.
It's interesting because there's a lot of messages coming in about the response to him individually. For instance, William Ragg should be sacked. His conduct is dreadful and a terrible example of someone involved in the leadership of our country. There are others perhaps with a more sympathetic view, not least some of his colleagues we were just hearing about from Noah. But the ire from somebody like Andrea, as I say, the first woman to speak about this is palpable. But there, you know, others saying this is the time we live in, we're all still learning. You don't sound like you can come down on that side of things.
Well, not quite. I mean, you know, there have been attempted stings at well, and some successful ones at MPs. They were previously done by email, you know, offering MPs jobs. They go to a meeting, they say things unwisely, and they're being recorded all the time. This has been going on for a long time. So no MP, nobody actually, should answer an email or a text message from somebody unless they're clear about who it's from and who the organisation is that they purport to represent. So, I mean, Will clearly knows he did something wrong. It's not an excuse, but it is an explanation. And that is, if you are an MP and you are single and looking for a relationship, it's quite tricky because becoming an MP, you give up some of your privacy. And not only that, you take on a responsibility, and that is to demonstrate very high standards. Will fell well short of that. He compromised other MPs. And as I say, I think he would be wise to stand aside from every committee that he is on.
And the whip?
I don't know. I'm not an MP now. I mean, he's a man who's suffered from mental health problems in the past. I would take into, if I was there now, I would take into account his mental state. But as I say, he should stand aside. He shouldn't be sacked. He should stand aside and try and regather some dignity from this terrible and, you know, this terrible situation, really.
We do, and I'm mindful, and I remember us speaking about this when you were the first woman to hold that particular role in the Whip's office for the Conservatives. But I remember us talking about perhaps what that lens brought to your position, but also some of the unique aspects of when you do give up your privacy as an MP, as a woman, sometimes what that can entail and some of the threats and some of the abuse. I suppose it's just interesting as well at this point to see this happening, firstly through a man, through a male MP, but also how both male and female MPs have to kind of navigate this world now and those vulnerabilities. Do you think for those who are not understanding how MPs could be so vulnerable and have been in this case, not in all of the cases, sorry, but in how this began, do you think the training is there? Do you think there is the right support?
Well, there should be. I mean, there absolutely should be. You know, it's the same with email. It's the same with text messages. Do not respond. I mean, right back in the day when I first got elected, which is nearly 20 years ago now, I can remember, you know, messages from the Whip's office saying, please do not participate in surveys. Noah might not be terribly pleased with this. Please do not participate in surveys. They're rarely useful. And the thing is, unsolicited approaches from people should be checked out.
Yes.
Before you give away anything. It is difficult. And I think in the situation of Will Ragg, one needs to separate excuses and explanations and also bear in mind that, you know, MPs are 650 of them. They have got the same number of people who suffer from alcohol problems, drug problems, mental health problems and all the rest of it. The job of the Whip's office is to support people. And sometimes that support is quite intense to make sure they don't get in situations like this. You can't, of course, always prevent it,
no.
But that support does need to be in place.
It's also interesting here, again, but a sort of bigger comment, but a message about WhatsApp and what should be allowed and not be allowed. The solution is MPs shouldn't be allowed to have WhatsApp on their phones. I was in banking and we were banned by the regulators from having it. I mean, again, there's another way perhaps people can reach each other, but there is a concern coming through from some of our listeners about the vulnerabilities and the way to access our elected officials. And also we've heard on this programme many times specifically about the abuse women receive through a variety of channels and whether that is going to put off the next generation.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if it did. And I think it's very sad, particularly for women. You know, we need more female MPs. We have done we have done for years, and it's not getting better, but it's not getting any easier to encourage women to do it, because I think women are disproportionately targeted, particularly particularly over the sort of death threats and abuse they get. The answer to the phones is have two phones. Have a work. I mean, if I was still in the House of Commons, I would do that. Have a work phone and a personal phone. Have WhatsApp on your personal phone. But, you know, as Noah rightly said, it's not difficult to get hold of MPs' phone numbers, but you use a work phone for journalists and for the media and for your constituents and all the rest of it. So at least you have got some way of filtering out the messages that you wouldn't respond to.
Did you happen to see, just while you're here, Anne, as a former member of the Conservatives, do you happen to see this poster about Britain from the Conservatives account talking about what's good in the world about this this country? It didn't feature any women. It's now been pulled. It had His Majesty, the Prime Minister, some male footballers. I don't know if you had a look at that.
I haven't seen it. I heard it discussed on the radio. I mean, no women and you put in the king. I mean, how could you get it so wrong? I'm appalled at some. I mean, not particularly with the Conservatives, but with them all. I'm appalled at some of the social media videos that the political parties are putting out. It is a signal just how desperate everybody is.
Well,
I'm pretty shocked, actually.
Well, you are, as I said, the first woman to hold that particular post, former Conservative Deputy Chief Whip in the Conservative Party. Always good to get your take. I mean, we don't know when the election is, so we don't know how much longer we'll have these sorts of messages, I suppose, coming to us via social media. Not the other messages we were talking about, but perhaps not even this year. It might be right at the start of next year, Anne.
Well, it's a very long general election campaign, and I fear it will get worse. I mean, there have been some slip-ups with videos from the Conservative Party. I mean, what in heaven's name persuaded them to put the king on a message?
They're not here. They're not here. We've asked a lot of people on the programme this morning. We're very happy you said yes, Anne. So let's take it with that, shall we? Anne Milton, former Conservative Deputy Chief Whip, former Minister and MP. Thank you for your take on that initial story, which also many of you have got in touch about. And I was just also hearing, to put us in the picture, from Noah Hoffman, The Sun's political correspondent. Judith's written in to say, it concerns me about the trend for sending such photos. What kind of role model are they to young people who we are discouraging from sending such photos? It doesn't require a lot of intelligence to foresee what the outcome of such activity will be. Another, if you use a non-smartphone, which does not have a photographic capacity, you avoid surprise rude images from vulgar scammers. Simple, says this listener. William Rag should be sacked. His conduct is dreadful and a terrible example of someone involved in the leadership of our country. And another, I was bombarded with texts and WhatsApp messages out of the blue from a stranger just last week. He knew my name and wanted me to start a conversation with him. I did, of course, ignore all of the messages. The very next day, the story about MPs came out. It's interesting, we've discussed this sort of issue before, specifically to do with women. There's actually some data around women perhaps being at times, or certain women being more vulnerable to romance scams. There was actually a study in last year from Lloyds Banking Group found men were more likely to succumb to romance scams, but only slightly. They made up 52% of cases, but we have discussed it from the women's point of view, and I remember some of those stories. So it's very interesting to get your take. A lot of you commenting on the story, which is very interesting to hear. If you have an experience as well and you wish to get in touch, the number, I hope, safely to get in touch on, 84844, or you can email via the Woman's Hour website. But to something completely different, belly button piercings, they are back. Or perhaps yours never went away. Perhaps you're still very happy with it. During the late 90s and early 2000s, belly button piercings were everywhere. Popularised by celebrities at the time, such as Britney Spears and Beyonce, it became an almost teenage rite of passage to get a sparkling bar through your navel. Cringing, remembering it. But the trend has slowly faded and had slowly faded away by the 2010s. Until now, with 90s and Y2K fashion back in style, so is belly button piercing, apparently. And Gen Z pop stars such as Dua Lipa, Addison Rae, Billie Eilish, Ice Spice have all been showing glittering gemstones in their navels. Karen Dacre, fashion director at the Sunday Times, got her belly button pierced the first time around, and she's here alongside Dr. Helga Gilmeister, reader of psychology at the University of Essex, who's studied the appeal of piercing. A warm welcome to both of you. Karen, when did you first have yours done and why? Tell us.
I was 16, just turned, I think, and I begged and begged and begged to have it done. And then I turned 16 and my grandmother, who was a bit of a wild rebel herself, gave me the money, and off I went to Edinburgh on my own and found it was like a word of mouth tattoo parlor at the time, where everyone went, you chose the bar with the bead you wanted and off you went.
What did you choose? What was the design?
It's a silver bar with a bright blue kind of gemstone right lodged in the middle of my navel.
Oh, lovely! You're reminding me of one of those trolls that I like, with the gemstones in the belly button. You remember
it's
those?
All about the colour. There was real currency in what colour you chose at
there
that
was.
Time. Correctly, yeah, exactly.
I'm sure trolls are back as well now, if we're going back in time and collecting those. But for you, was it rebellion? Was it a sign of total fashion? You're obviously a fashion editor.
I mean, it was MTV, 100%. It was all I was consuming. Those were the heyday of music videos. You came home from school, you found a TV channel that was streaming All Saints, Britney Spears, all those kind of icons of the time, and you had your sights set firmly on that, and that's where you went. I guess it was also rebellion at that time as well. It was the first thing that I did that maybe my mum didn't approve of.
I love it. Well, I was just going to say, I love that your grandmother funded it. You know, that's another level here. I'm really enjoying that aspect. When was the great removal?
I think It's hard to recall exactly. There was a long crop top period, I believe, around my early 20s. And then I think probably I went off to university and realised that maybe it wasn't the thing anymore. There's still a hole, though. So when I stand in the shower, the water delightfully runs through my navel. And that's post having two children. So, you know, it doesn't go away.
That's nice. That's nice. Actually, I don't know. Can you keep it in? I don't know if you can keep it in while you're pregnant, but probably not. Not advised by a certain point, is it?
I definitely didn't try.
No. Okay, fine. And what do you make, as someone who follows fashion for a living, what do you make of the trend returning?
I think it's like anything. These things are cyclical and they come back again and again. But I think, I don't know, if you're 18, you're doing it now because your icons on TikTok or wherever you're kind of consuming your information, they have them. But I also think piercing is always a mark of rebellion. It makes you feel in control. It's kind of a nice kind of way to claim your own body, I suppose. And I think often women do these things because, especially on their navels, because you can cover it up. It's one, you can't go to work. Maybe you can't go to work with a bell in your eyebrow, but you can happily have hidden away the fact that you're still a rebel at heart, maybe.
Yes. Well, that's interesting. Let's talk to Dr. Helga Gilmeister about why this happens. What do we know of the history of this and why it happens?
Good morning. Thanks for having me. So the history of piercings is long and sort of really embedded in our human story, and you see it across all cultures. So it is in a way a ubiquitous form of self-expression. Now, piercings, I think, so in terms of the recorded history, dates back at least 5,000 years. And that's mostly, I think, the most well-documented forms are in the face, or the ears, the nose, and in the lips or the mouth region, the tongue, and so on. So with the belly button piercing, however, you will read that seemingly ancient Egyptian pharaohs had them as a mark of nobility or so. So often piercings are to signal status, to signal group membership, as a sort of a rite of passage, which you mentioned earlier. But when I looked into this, and actually this Egyptian pharaoh story seems more of a myth than fact. So it's more likely that actually belly button piercings are really a sign of the 20th century. So sort of warmed up through the counterculture movements of the 70s and 80s, and then really taking hold like they did for you, Karen, in the 90s and the sort of early 2000s. So and by that time, they'd sort of overtaken or been on a par with earlobe kind of piercings in terms of popularity. But they're very specific to women. I think this is sort of where I was really interested in them. Yes. Because, yeah, men don't really tend to have them. And they are in a part of the body that for women is often one that they feel less satisfied with. So if you ask women and if you see where they sort of fixate on images, then it's the abdominal region, hips and thighs, that women are often less satisfied with. So it was sort of interesting to me because I'm interested in body representations, body image. Why women would pierce their body, and whether this has something to do with increasing that body image, with enhancing your kind of feeling or feeling attractive to yes. yourself, to others, and that's kind of where the study that we did came in.
And well, no, that is fascinating, and to think about that, as you will know, Karen, from where women have typically at times, some women I should say, felt less satisfied about their bodies, perhaps adorning it with a blue gemstone in your case may enhance and make you feel like you've owned it or dressed it up.
I think there's also an element of, it's almost like the belly piercing becomes a highlighter for your success in inverted commas. So it's become, if you've done loads of work in the gym, you've got an amazing flat stomach, it's become a sort of, certainly on the red carpet, that's what we see. We see these women who have these incredible bodies. And then the belly button's like the icing on the cake to say, hi, here's my perfectly toned stomach, which is why mine is definitely under wraps now. But I definitely think there's an element of it becomes a way to showboat this thing, this great part of your body.
You've also had a look at the fact that the women in and generally coming away from belly button now, that piercings for women in their 30s, 40s and 50s, women still going along that track. And
I think,
go on, tell us a bit more about that.
I've written a lot about midlife piercings recently because we find, certainly around the women I socialize with and the women I see, piercing has never been more popular, whether it's, and not just kind of the classic earlobe piercing, which I know you don't have, Emma.
I know, it's good with the headphones. They go straight on. It's really neat unicorn. With this work.
All the kind of ways up the ears, different part that people in now pierce the inside of the inner ear, like, which the heat. There's so many. And there's a huge rise of kind of luxury boutique style piercing places, which has come with that rise of kind of midlife piercing. So places like Maria Tash, who's an American jeweler stroke piercer, she has a concession in Liberty in London. So that's the place if you want a midlife piercing, that's where everyone goes. They do a belly button bar, which is about, I think, about £600.
Other piercing places available, I'll say at this point, other on the BBC. But you also, I'll come back to you, Helga, in just a moment, but you've also seen the rise, well, it's, I'm sure, been the case for some time, but you've noted the rise of mothers and daughters as well, trying to find perhaps some commonality in the piercing world.
We have a jewellery editor on the Sunday Times whose daughter begged and begged, teenage daughter, was, I think she was 15 when she finally relinquished, because you have to, if you're under 16, I think currently in this country, you go with an adult and they provide concession for permission for you to have the piercing done. But I think it's an increasingly popular trend for the mother and daughter to have the piercing together. So maybe the daughter has the belly button and the mum has some sort of extra hole put in her ear. I guess it's a bonding exercise of sorts.
I felt like everybody's mother when this was happening in Manchester at Affleck's Palace. I was not doing any of this, but just watching and holding people's hands and then helping them hide it from their mother. Helga, when we go back through history and we look at why women do get pierced, or perhaps doing it together, what else can we say from your look at this?
I don't really know, but I mean there is this sort of encouraging group cohesion kind of element to, there's a ritualistic element to it, so that's certainly known about in history, yes. So.
And just coming away from people doing it together, but when you were looking at why women do it and that whole relationship, was there anything you hadn't been expecting?
Not so much. I mean, we sort of, you mentioned sort of rebelliousness earlier, and that certainly was one of the reasons, but far more common was indeed the sort of women wanting to increase their physical attractiveness. So the thing with the belly, I mean, piercings have been studied, but just as a group of, you know, body modifications to do. Nobody had really looked at navel piercings, or, you know, as we call them, belly piercings, in isolation. So that's what we did. And here we really saw that there was this body image and enhancing element there. And we also saw that about a third of the women that we surveyed said that they hated their belly before they had their navel pierced. So, we really think that although we saw these sort of positive effects on body image and self-perception that we found in our study across all of our sample, for some women in particular, that sort of adorning of this perhaps less loved part of their body can be like an act of self-care and perhaps reunite them with, yes, with that part of their body.
No, I mean, each their own. I if I can't understand it, I always like to try and understand it. And I see that for people, that it's a way of ownership. Same with tattoos. There's lots of different ways people are customising themselves and reclaiming different parts. And it is really fascinating. Dr. Helga Gilmeister, thank you, Reader of Psychology at the University of Essex. And Karen Dacre, Fashion Director at the Sunday Times. No belly button piercing in at the moment, but definitely remembers what that experience was like. And I'm sure some of you will be able to relate, whether it's belly button or elsewhere in the body. I mean, from Barbara here, why torture your body? We could add waxing to that list. No piercings on me. But Jean says, I celebrated my 60th birthday by getting my nose pierced. A lifelong ambition. Happy birthday to you, Jean. There you go. So keep those messages coming in. But I did mention, and this did prompt a message straight away, about the new self-help gurus, maybe living a little closer than you think if you have young children. Don't worry about them on social media. We're talking about toddlers. You might have one in your life. You may live with one, as I say, or you may know one through a friend who has one, or you may have had them before. We've definitely all been them, but apparently they could be the best teachers of self-improvement. Dr. Hassan Morali is here to make the case, in case your eyebrows just shot off of your face. He's an emergency paediatric doctor and associate professor at McMaster University in Canada, and the author of Sleep Well, Take Risks, Squish the Peas, Secrets from the Science of Toddlers for a Happier, More Successful Way of Life. He joins me now, I'm sure very early, in Toronto. Good morning.
Good morning. It's nice to be here.
Thank you for coming to tell us why we need to perhaps listen to those who have sometimes quite a bad reputation, toddlers, because we do badge toddlers in quite a negative way sometimes, don't we?
Yeah, and I think that's a little bit unfair. I mean, I understand it because that's when they're getting attention, when they're having their tantrums. But if we put it into perspective, those tantrums, median time is only about 3 minutes, and they're awake for 11 to 12 hours a day. And so what I like to focus on is how they're spending those other hours of their day. And that's laughter, playing, building relationships, spending time learning. And so I think toddlers do a lot of things right. And if we look at the data around adults who act in certain ways, like toddlers, you'll see that it really helps us be more happier and less stressed.
Take us to some of the specifics. Well, what do you think you can learn from an individual who obviously can't go to the toilet by themselves, doesn't have a responsibility in many senses, and is heavily reliant on others and screams when they don't get what they want? What tell us what we can learn.
Sure. So there's one I think that people don't think of as much, but there's a lot of great data behind it, and that's self-talk. So I have a three-year-old, and when I go pick her up at preschool and I'm walking down the halls, I hear a lot of laughter and encouragement. But when I see the toddlers by themselves, they're doing a lot of things out loud. Little Julie's putting on her mitts and saying, "Julie can do it." And Colton's over on the side and he's looking down at his boots and they're on the wrong way. And so he says, "Oh, Colton did this wrong." And this idea of self-talk is really a way to decrease stress in anxiety-provoking situations. There's a lot of great studies with adults where they're in MRI machines, they're shown aversive images, and they're asked to do one of two different things. What am I feeling right now? Or what is Hassan feeling right now, for example, and talking to yourself in third person. And we see that the areas of the brain that are involved with emotional reactivity are actually decreased. And so self-talk is one of these wonderful lessons we can learn from toddlers that has a lot of great data if we were able to do it as adults. And it's a very simple thing to do.
That's what's interesting about your book, having dipped in and out in the last few days, when my children would allow, with a one-year-old and a six-year-old. But, you know, we're just at the beginning of toddlerdom again. I believe the official start is one, and then goes to around three or so, you say in your book. But you've got a lot of evidence in there. You've looked at studies, or rather you've looked at what studies have been done as well, to show and to back up some of what you're saying. So self-talk is a really interesting one. And you can imagine, you would hope, that a toddler's self-narrative, self-talk, isn't as negative as adults can become when they do talk to themselves.
Yeah, exactly. They're much more positive. And, you know, that's one of the great strategies that we can implement with ourselves as well. Like, we often get into the cycle of negative self-talk. And I think one of the best strategies that we can do is give ourselves more positive self-talk. So an easy way to do it is, when you're down on yourself and angry with yourself, think about talking to yourself as a good friend, instead of actually you. And you'll notice that difference in how you talk to yourself. And I think that's another simple change that we could make to make our own self-talk more positive.
I was thinking of our conversation last night because I was also struck by sleep, okay? You talk a lot about how toddlers, or rather those in charge of toddlers, prioritize their sleep. But toddlers themselves do, because everything really goes wrong if they haven't had what they need in that department. And I was slightly wryly laughing at myself, because I had a lot to do once said children were in bed last night, which didn't get me to bed, I think, till midnight nearly. And I really wasn't messing around. There was shopping to unload, tidying, cleaning, washing, you know, all of that. And my partner, my husband, doing the same. And I was thinking, I need to go to sleep now. 8 o'clock, I was ready. But there was a lot to do, including think about this conversation and today's programme. So it's quite challenging to try and directly apply it, but sleep is a good one.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's probably the foundation of wellness, is really getting good sleep. And I think if there's one takeaway of what people can do to improve their lives, is getting better sleep. And the toddler sleep routine is perfect, and it works so well for adults. It's so simple. It's just three easy steps. So an hour before you want to go to sleep, you take a hot bath or shower. Number two, for toddlers, it's applying lotion, and that can be applying lotion or some other hygiene activity. and always, like every toddler, needs to read a book before bed. And none of this involves any screen time. And reading is another thing they excel at, but that's a nice way to end the toddler bedtime routine and easily adaptable for adults and definitely helps with sleep.
Right, well, I'm going to set a bedtime. That's what I decided after reading some of your book and try to stick to it. I hope not to miss the target. And there's also around food. There's some interesting take on food. I know the part of the title is called Squish the Peas, but eating when you need and eating what you need.
Yeah, I mean, toddlers are the original mindful eaters. They're very in tune with their bodies, and it's actually very difficult to make a toddler overeat. And that's where really the Squish the Peas comes from. It's their playfulness and everything, but it's really when they're full, they kind of just play with their food. Or sometimes, and this is another great toddler lesson, say no in a more powerful way than anyone is able to, because they know when they're getting full and they can stop when they're eating and they don't eat for all the reasons that adults do often because of boredom, because they're with another person, because they're in front of the TV. And I think that's another great lesson from toddlers is how to listen to our bodies a bit better when we're eating.
Although, as someone who really wants to make sure that the child is full, you know, it isn't always when they aren't full. It's they might not like that thing. They may have got bored. You know, that's quite tricky territory, that one, I think, to slide across.
It is trickier. And of course, yeah, we want to make sure that they eat enough. But certainly, I think as parents, and from what I see in my own practice, is that the worry is overhyped in parents because if their child is tracking along their growth curve just fine, then they're able to regulate their own intake better than adults think they can do it for them, for their own toddlers.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking during an obesity crisis in the Western world, of course, and you'll be well aware of that as a doctor, albeit as a paediatrician. But I think it's also there must be some irony for you putting this together, both as a parent and as a doctor looking after children, because there'll be some parents listening to this or remembering if those days are behind them, if they've had them at all or wanted to and haven't been able to. I'm always mindful of that. But there'll be those who thought, well, I actually had life pretty nailed, and then I did have a toddler, and my sleep went out the window. My ability to say no to sugar went out of the window, or a lot more sugar than normal. You can see where I'm going with this.
Yeah, and certainly that's true. And parents do get a break because being around a little person is challenging because they're so active and they want to do so many different things, and it's tiring. I have a 3-year-old and I'm tired, but I'll tell you, in the last 2 years since she was one, I have never laughed as much as I have. And every day is filled with a lot of laughter and a lot of games. And there's so many better things in my life now because of her. Like, she's asleep right now, but as soon as she gets up, she's going to come over here and start spinning me in my chair and start
See,
laughing. And that's going to be a lot of fun.
she's having more sleep. You had to go to work. This is some of the issue. You're promoting what you've found here. A message just came in from one of our listeners here in the UK. We're just talking, if you're joining, Dr. Hassan Morali is talking to us from Canada. Woman's Hour, regarding self-talk, is that the same as talking to yourself? I'm 65 and three quarters. I do it all of the time. Do we say that's the same as talking to yourself?
Yes, exactly. It's talking to yourself, but just changing the I to second or third person. So you need to use your own name when you're doing things, and that can help decrease anxiety in stressful situations. It can help with sports, for example, scoring more basketball shots. And then it can also, in the opposite way, help us get rid of the rumination that sometimes can lead to insomnia when we're talking to ourselves in a more positive way.
Okay, so replace it with that and then go for it. A message here saying everything your expert's saying about learning from toddlers reminds me how much the elderly have in common with 2-year-olds. And another one here, though, different take, which we have to just come to while I have you. I think if we're throwing a tantrum to get what we wanted, then we'd be happy, but we'd certainly end up single and alone. But if it's jumping in puddles and kicking up leaves, then it's a resounding yes from me, says Michelle, who's listening. The emotional regulation piece, that what do you say about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's challenging. And I'm not arguing that they're perfect. They do have a lot of issues that they're slowly working on. And that's just part of their development. And they'll get there. What I want to say is that we as adults should be looking to how we used to act a little bit more and how they act all the time. And that will certainly help us a lot in our own lives.
And there's a great example right at the beginning of the book where you talk, just because, you know, it's not to hold you to every single part of a toddler and we have to transfer it over. It's just interesting to ask you that question. And I'm not trying to be pedantic about it, and I'm sure our listeners aren't either, but where you talk about the spaghetti marshmallow challenge. So it's a good example. Why don't you explain around creativity and how your brain stops working as you get older?
Yeah. So as we get older, we develop our prefrontal cortex, which, you know, helps us plan, think about the future, a lot of important things. But toddler minds, they're able to just absorb everything around them. And that helps them be more creative. And they don't have all the pattern recognition that we have because their brains are still developing that. And so the marshmallow challenge is a great one. So you get 20 sticks of spaghetti, a yard of tape, a yard of string, and one marshmallow. And you have to build the largest tower. And so kindergartners were pitted against a wide variety of adults, and they beat out almost every single group of adults except for engineers, but certainly business students, lawyers, other groups of adults, because that toddler or childhood mindset can make us more creative.
Just finally, that's always, I think, it's fascinating to give an example like that, and it is a fascinating one and quite dispiriting in some ways. Pay inequality between the sexes, you have something on that to say?
Yeah, absolutely. I talk about this a little bit about in the book, and it's something that just would not exist in toddler world, because, you know, we talk a lot about disadvantageous inequity when we have less, or women are paid less than men for the same type of work. But what toddlers are also concerned about, yes, they're concerned about that, and they will protest that, is something called advantageous inequity, when they have more than others. So if you take a group of three-year-olds, you have them work in pairs with someone else, and then you give them a reward. And for toddlers, it's always stickers, because that's the highest currency. And so if you give them more than their partner that they worked with on a project, they will do one of two things. One, they'll reject it, or two, they'll happily accept it and then redistribute those rewards with their partner. And this is true repeatedly, whether they're working with another toddler, whether they're working with an adult, whether they're working with a puppet. And so this idea of fairness is very strong in toddlerdom.
Toddlerdom, you've taken us into it, and there'll be those who are living it right now, but perhaps a different lens, which is why it was good to hear from you. Dr. Hassan Morali, I'll let you get you back to being spun in your chair when your little one wakes up. The book is called Sleep Well, Take Risks, Squish the Peas, Secrets from the Science of Toddlers for a Happier, More Successful Way of Life. That is something else entirely different. And you may have read about this, you may have heard about this, you may have wondered why this is happening. Let's tell you more. This year's Women's Tennis Association finals are to be held in November in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia's capital, as part of a three-year deal estimated to be worth £55 million. It means tennis is just the latest sport behind boxing, Formula One and football to join a growing list that are holding big events in Saudi. Even before the final decision was made, the idea had prompted criticism from high circles, with tennis legends Martina Navratilova and Chris Evert writing in the Washington Post that this is a step backwards for women and women's sport, and airing their concerns about Saudi Arabia's human rights record and its restrictions on women's lives. But Billie Jean King, one of the trailblazing founders of this tournament and a champion of both women and LGBTQ plus communities, supports the move, saying it could help drive change in the region. Molly McElwee is a freelance sports journalist, and Madawi Al-Rashid is a visiting professor at the LSC Middle East Centre. They both join me now. Molly, I'll come to you first. Tell us, how important are these finals? Welcome to the programme.
Thanks for having me. They're really important. I'd say the WTA finals are the most important. It's the most important tournament outside of the Grand Slams, really. So it's the WTA's kind of crown jewel event. So it's very significant that they've decided to take it to Saudi Arabia. And not surprising, because last year they kind of toyed with the idea before making a last-minute decision to take it to Cancun for 1 year. So I think everyone knew this was coming, but still it's huge news and a big shift in tennis and women's tennis in particular.
And what is the reason, and what has been the reaction? Give us a sense of that if you can.
So like you said, with the reaction from Chris Evert, for example, and Martina Navratilova, there's been some pushback from former players, but on the whole, the current crop of top players haven't been against this idea. They've been quite supportive of the idea of going to Saudi Arabia. And that in big part is due to the fact that the WTA finals have been a bit of a mess for the last 3 years or so. So the WTA had a long-term deal to host the finals in China, but that ended in 2020 after concerns over Chinese doubles player Peng Shuai's safety. And so the WTA decided to take the tournament away from China. But since then, there's been a lot of instability. They've not had a long-term deal that's caused financial instability for the organization. And so in a big way, like we've seen Saudi Arabia go to a lot of other sports, the WTA was the part of tennis, I think, that was most vulnerable to this because of the instability that's been caused by the end of their long-term deal in China.
So money is... I mean, and stability, I suppose, are key drivers here, but it's also a record prize amount. Is that right?
Yes, it is a record prize money. So that's a big part of it. And it's something that the players have really been calling for. In men's tennis, this $50 million prize pot has existed for their finals event. And I think the women have vocalized their kind of discontent in recent years about prize money not being equal. So this move from the WTA has, in a big way, is kind of trying to bring women's tennis up to men's tennis in terms of prize money. But yeah, there's the big issue also of going to Saudi Arabia in that the WTA is meant to be and has always been this organization that has stood for and was founded on kind of women's rights and equality, and obviously to take its biggest event to Saudi Arabia causes a lot of concern over their human rights record there.
Well, yes, and specifically the treatment of women as a women's tournament. What about players who are openly gay? Are there concerns from those individuals' camps?
Yeah, so the only kind of high-profile player who's spoken out against the tour taking the finals to Saudi Arabia has been Daria Kazatkina. She's a Russian player who's gay, and she was kind of the only player last year when asked about this potential move who said she was concerned about it. The WTA has confirmed that same-sex couples can share rooms and accommodation while at the event, but obviously those are not the same rights afforded to people who live in Saudi Arabia. And so she has spoken about how she's concerned about this move, but most of the other players haven't shared any of that concern. So it's interesting because we've seen in other sports, I think, a lot, that yes, there's been a more conversation around it, whereas here the current crop of players have mostly been in support of the move.
Let me bring in Professor Madawi Al-Rashid, originally from Saudi Arabia. What is your response to this, and how can you describe the way women's lives in Saudi differ to the men's at the moment?
Good morning. Yes, I mean, it's a big surprise, but I'm actually not surprised, as this is one of the latest episodes in the way Saudi Arabia had succeeded in attracting high profile sport into the country. Molly mentioned the money, and they have capitalized on the financial problems that, for example, football teams like Newcastle or others, the Gulf area, and attracted them to Saudi Arabia, offering money. Now, in terms of the situation in Saudi Arabia, as far as women's rights are concerned, it's a part of the declared intention of the leadership is to empower women. However, on the ground, we see a very big gap between the narrative about Saudi Arabia opening up, empowering women, and how women's lives are affected and how they live their lives. For example, freedom of expression for men and women is very, very restricted. We have a case in the UK of a Saudi PhD student in Leeds, Salma Shihabi, who simply tweeted some critical opinion about policies in Saudi Arabia. And when she returned over Christmas for the Christmas holiday, she was immediately detained and later sentenced to over 3 decades in prison for what is called her activism. And activism meant that she has been active online, calling for greater rights for women. It's a disappointment that all the sports associations and foundations are rushing to Saudi Arabia under the, with the promise of financial reward. It remains very, very a difficult situation for women. And while many women in the country may enjoy the spectacle of this highly praised sport, but we know, for example, there is Fawzal Utaybi, who is a sport instructor. She is in prison since 2022. And until now, her situation is very difficult simply because of calling for real emancipation and not simply, sports washing or the glamorous appointments that the leadership had made, for example, appointing a woman as ambassador in Washington, appointing women to high-profile positions. But everybody knows that appointment is really not empowerment.
There were some specific cases there. We had been in touch with representatives from the Saudi government, but hadn't asked about those specific cases. But when you're talking about the life and the experience of women in Saudi Arabia at the moment, and then with this lens on this women's tennis tournament, are you saying that you have no hope in any way that by doing or by holding these sorts of tournaments and these competitions in Saudi Arabia with the world's eyes on, this is the argument from the likes of Billie Jean King that I don't wish to pray-see her, but what she seems to have sort of said is around perhaps you can be part of change and sport can help change. Is there any faith that you have in that?
Well, there are two views. There is one side which says that, engagement with an authoritarian regime might bring change because of the exposure that you've mentioned. And on the other hand says that, boycotting is a way of putting pressure on a dictatorship, basically, an absolute monarchy where people don't have any rights, no elected government. It is the only country in the region that doesn't have an elected national assembly or a parliament, and it's a one-man show, basically. So between those two extreme situations, I think there is probably a middle ground, and that is when these kind of events and associations, football, tennis, golf, etc., make their engagement with Saudi Arabia conditional on certain change that actually affects the lives of the people. So it's not total boycott or total endorsement that will work. It's just in all these situations a middle ground whereby any kind of involvement in Saudi Arabia is conditional on the country abiding by the international values and norms with regard to gender equality. And this also applies to the sales of arms to Saudi Arabia, like the British government is number two. And it has to make that engagement conditional on Saudi Arabia becoming a respected member of the international community.
Yeah, well, we're going to have to leave it there in terms of my time, but Madawi Al-Rashid, Visiting Professor at the LSE Middle East Centre. Thank you very much. And a message just on that from the Foreign Office here. We continue to engage closely with Saudi authorities on women's rights issues. They say positive steps have been made. They will always raise issues relating to freedom of speech. And the WTA chief executives told BBC Sport that it's been breaking down barriers for more than 50 years, and we want to create more opportunities for women to play tennis at the elite level and inspire more women and girls to be involved in it. And we are a global sport. Thank you for your company. I'll be back with you tomorrow at 10. That's all for today's Women's Hour. Thank you so much for your time. Join us again for the next one.
I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Secret Heroes, a new series of rarely heard tales from World War II.
None of them knew that she'd lived this double life. They had no idea that she was Britain's top female codebreaker.
We'll hear of daring risk takers.
What she was offering to do was to ski in over the high Carpathian Mountains in minus 40 degrees.
Of course it was dangerous, but danger was his friend. Helping people was in his blood.
Subscribe to History's Secret Heroes on BBC Sounds.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.